pretrial detainees. Over a quarter of them were whole probationers. So if you if you eliminate the if we had bail reform where 80% of the pretrial detainees were released, and we found alternative housing to the whole probationers who are not dangerous and don't need to be confined in this high security setting, we could probably build a that's just a small fraction of what they're planning. We could build one that is a lot cheaper, just a small fraction of what they're ready to spend now. And we could rethink who should be in it and what it should be doing, because all the focus so far has been on the building and the site, not on what the jail is supposed to do in the 21st century Honolulu, where most of the people who are in there are poor, mentally ill, have drug addiction problems, and are homeless. So that's, I hope that the Oversight Commission will put that on the agenda for the future, and we can all work together to come up with some better ideas than we see from the Department of Public Safety at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark, I have an aside. I just got a text from Kevin Dayton, two texts. He and Kat are trying to get in. They cannot get into the meeting. And he asked if we can halt until this is worked out. I don't know whether that's appropriate or not. But he's trying to get in. Kevin Dayton from Civil Beat and Kat Brady.
Oh.
I think they might have communicated with each other that they could not get into the meeting. So Kevin requested a halt again. I don't know whether that's appropriate or not, but I wanted to pass that message on to you.
At the right time.
I just sent them a leak. The same one I sent Esther. Same one I sent some of you, and you're here. So let's just continue on at this point.
So did you send them a new link?
Yes.
I have a short footnote to Bob.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I've been following what Atlanta did, Mayor Bottoms there with the Kresge Foundation, where she, in building the new jail, reimagined an equity center that's not just a jail lockup, but follows what our Act 179 suggests, or more rehabilitation. And I want to commend that. I sent it out to our commissioners, and I'd like to, I guess, incorporate by reference in the record what Kresge, God forbid I could spell Kresge. You know how to spell it? K-R-E-S-G, something like that. But they have an equity center where you build strengths, and it's not about lock them all up. And I agree with Bob that we need to look at this thing very carefully. And we need to have it on the agenda, every single oversight commission, to reimagine what the jail is. And it's way more than a public works project, or way more than lock them up type project. So I hope we continue to discuss this.
Well, I think at this point it's appropriate to ask Fred if, and it might not be fair to Fred because he's very new in the position, but if the department plans to continue to push for this project, especially in the upcoming legislature.
Oh, did you know I'm the actor, right? So last where we're at, we had discussions on it, and we're going to go forward with the procurement process. So any other debates and inputs as far as trying to redesign it, you know, can come in place later on, but we need to start moving on it.
But what procurement process is that, Fred?
It's to open it up, you know, as far as bidders and vendor types.
Right, but what's the purpose of the process? What are you looking for? What services are you looking for?
Well, we already started the planning and design, okay? And I think there was about approximately $4 million that went out for that. So that process moving forward, we didn't want to stop, or as far as I've heard, we didn't want to stop it. and just move forward. Otherwise, we have a stall, and with everything else, with overcrowding and all the criticisms we receive, where does it begin? You know, I hear Bob, we've had enough discussions on ATR 85. You know, we just need to start moving.
Right, but what I'm not clear about is, what are you gonna achieve through the next step in the process?
Well,
what product are you gonna get?
Well, after, my understanding is, after the procurement goes out, then we'll entertain for any vendors who, well, you gotta do the specs, right, in the process. We have to put all of that, the specifications out for people or willing bidders to review, and then come up with what their capabilities are or are not.
But I'm still not clear for it. Are you asking for vendors who can move it to the design stage?
Yeah, I believe so, you know.
What about the financing methodology that's been mentioned in the media, private public partnership? Is that going to be part of the next step also? Is that something that's going to be down the road?
I think that will be down the road. But let me tell you, as far as the article, my understanding is NACASA is going to be doing two or three more articles every Sunday. So some of the things that Bob may say is missing could be brought out. I don't know. I've not had any communications with NACASA. I only understand what his intent is, and that was to provide information to the public via these series of articles.
Mark, I think we need to schedule an update for our next meeting on this subject.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that we do a separate subcommittee meeting so we can just focus on the subject of the building of a new prison, and then like we did with the bail reform meeting that we had, and so we can set a direction on where the commission wants to go in terms of the upcoming legislative session. So I agree.
That'd be fine. Well,
yeah, I'm thinking that whenever we meet, and if we meet in November, then we should have like an update from public safety on their plans and where they are on their plans, et cetera. What the next steps will be, what the timelines are, more information on the projected size of the facility, including bed space and services that will be included in this project.
That's fair enough.
Okay. Ked, I want to second that. I think we need to reimagine what a real good jail for Honolulu is like, given best practices. And I'm looking at, in my mind, I think about a good charrette process. That sounds like a fancy French word, which it is, but I have friends that do these charrettes to reimagine what a good jail is like in Atlanta. So to me, we got to put the brakes on real fast and figure out exactly what we want before we start tripping over ourselves. So I'm talking charrette or reimagining. And I agree, in November is a good time. There's a gal in town that does good charrettes, Cindy Sakai. She does with things.
No relation. Huh? No relation to me. Never heard of her.
Okay, we'll consider that and take that up on the next agenda. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your concerns at this time. Those of you who have just joined me, I'm sorry. I don't know what the Zoom issues are today. But we are taking some testimony from the public at this time in the beginning of the meeting rather than the end on the agenda items. Bob is the first one to go. Does anybody else have anything to say at this time on the agenda items? Kat, Carrie Ann.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Carrie Ann. I'm just wondering the reason, the rationale for the difference in the timing. Sometimes it's really helpful for the community to listen to the discussion and then to comment rather than the reverse.
Lisa, you want to explain?
Well, I understand your comment. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Brian Black from Civil Beat chimed in and instructed me and several others that, in fact, public testimony should come in at the beginning of a meeting, before the board, I guess, makes any decisions or takes up any subjects. That was his rationale for the instruction. So per his instruction, we move the public testimony to the front. I understand your concern, and we can still have public testimony at the end as well, but this is why we have to change the agenda.
Thank you for that explanation. Sorry, I'm trying to pull up.
Okay, not hearing anything else from the community on today's agenda, we're going to go ahead and begin the meeting on the other agenda items. Just a note before we begin, I may have to leave a little after 10 o'clock for another meeting, unfortunately, and then Ted will take over as the chair. But the meeting will still be recorded and will still be moving on, though you may not hear from me. So I want to thank Fred Hewn for showing up today and being part of our commission meeting. Congratulations for your appointment as the acting director of the Department of Public Safety. I'm just going to assume that you're going to speak on some of this, update us on the COVID-19 infection effort in the Department of Public Safety.
Best as possible.
Thanks, Fred. Floor is yours.
I'm sorry?
Oh, did you want to just go ahead and just update us on what's going on in terms of the testing?
Okay.
Well, I can ask.
No. I thought, as long as we're just following the agenda items, I didn't know that. I thought I was not necessarily a participant, but anyway, as far as the update on the COVID infections, the department had started mass testing, started with the prisons first, and took a cooperative effort between the National Guard and Department of Health and Public Safety. So at this point, Wayava, Women's, Halava are COVID-free. Staff were tested first, followed by inmates. So we have no infections at this time, right?
Oh my God.
Kulani is COVID as well. Guards tested, inmates tested. We're moving on to the CCCs, which were the most difficult ones on Kauai, Maui, and HCCC Big Island. And the problem with that was with the numbers. We didn't have enough space in which to coordinate an effective test plan and quarantine. So, and especially because we have construction and with the HCCC ADORM would not be ready until November. So basically we had to shuffle bodies, move all the sentenced felons out, parole violators out to provide enough room so that we could adequately test. And if anybody was found positive, we could effectively isolate them. So testing is underway for the neighbor island CCCs. Maui's ACOs are negative. HCCC's ACOs thus far are negative. HCCC's ACOs thus far are negative. So we now move to the inmate population. Okay. Arizona, to my knowledge, has 4 positives and 7 now. And they're in isolation. Todd Thomas is back to take reins in wardens. And he has assured us he has everything under control. And I have complete faith in Todd and have spoken with him and visited with him. and seeing the facilities, and they do have the capabilities and the real estate to isolate. So that's where we are right now with the COVID.
Commissioners, any question for the director?
Fred, Warden Thomas came back from being a super warden. He's back doing SWARL.
Well, what occurred was, I believe Fink was the last
right.
Coordinator. And Todd is the regional director who oversees
right.
that, as well as SWARL. So when COVID started breaking out, he was closely monitoring it, and you know, because of his affections for the Hawaii inmate. And just the other month, he came back on board and took over reins. And our conversations with it is, you know, at that time, there were no positives. And then one guard tested, and he started activating the troops. And then we got another inmate positive, and it started from there. So, well, now he's back in control.
When we were up there, the parole board went up there for 3, 4, 5 days. I regarded him as a straight shooter. So I appreciate that, Fred. Thank you.
He is very straight. Good guy.
And a big shooter with large aloha shirts.
Fred, this is Ron. Ara. Do you have a date or dates when the community correctional centers will be tested? Hawaii, Maui, and Kauai? I know you said you're going to be testing them.
They are, as I've told Senator Nishihara, we have a schedule, we have an order, and it's basically when we can get the forces together, because we need certified testers between National Guard and Department of Health. The National Guard only tests civilian ACO type staff. And DOH will do the testing with inmates. But I won't give any dates and I won't give any order, only because for security purposes. But they are in the process of being scheduled for testing.
So the fact that a facility will be tested is a security issue? I don't want people going to do the test. I just want the dates of the facilities when. Or if you can give a range, how about a range?
Well, we told the media that we would give them a week, but that would be subject to change because the order in which we may be doing it could test our resources. And like I said, we are using the National Guard, and that would be under Haima and General Hara, as well as with Department of Health.
You don't even have an outside date, like by a certain month or, you know?
They'll be happening this month and into next month.
Okay, okay. And that's in this month and next month, beginning with one correctional center?
Yes.
Or are you going to do it simultaneously?
No, it's very difficult to coordinate simultaneous, so we do it in order.
Okay. But so... Next month,
there is considerable effort going into this, and we have the healthcare administrator staying up till 12:30 at night reporting the results. And so people are working very hard. Healthcare workers are working very tired, and some of them are burned out. You should also realize that we have a lot of healthcare positions that were defunded by the legislature. So, you know, we want to make sure and pace our providers and helpers in this process.
Okay. Considering all that, Fred, you know, the burned out staff, everybody's working hard. What is the outside date which you looking at to complete the testing?
I would hope by the middle of next month.
Okay.
If not,
thank you.
I want to make comment about the defunding of positions. Fred, I reviewed the legislative website and testimony and other things on that. I understand the state is under great pressure to reduce spending. So the positions that were identified to be pre-funded, and there's many, many incorrections, were identified by the Department of Corrections and submitted to the legislature. So the legislature did not just work in a vacuum.
Fred, it's Ted. Back to your testing. Is this a one-time event, your mass testing? What are your plans after you complete the mass testing?
It is, the mass testing event is a one-time event. However, we're looking to do retesting once we get the rapid or quicker type tests out. So we're waiting for those things to come about because we should, you know, we can do one-time testing, but because of the nature of the virus, we need to do retesting. That is my position.
So if when you get the rapid testing kits, then you'll be able to test the new intakes or something like that as they come in?
Well, I would hope that new intakes are being isolated first, and then if they start to show signs within the quarantine period, they'll be tested with the higher accuracy test. The retesting that we would be looking at is testing the population as well as staff that has a quicker turnaround as far as results within 24 hours.
Yeah, my concern is that it's going to be really hard to isolate on the neighbor islands.
Well, and that was our challenge that we had initially.
Mark, at the right time, I wanted to, Carrie Ann had a comment about Saguaro and testing. I don't know the right time to do that, but maybe we make time for her at the right time.
Okay. Fred, I got a question on your, you know, when you talk about the testing in the, in all of the facilities, are in terms of staff as well as the inmates, are these all voluntary?
For OCCC, it is not voluntary. For the other facilities, it is voluntary for the staff.
Okay.
Because we've had union issues with that.
Right, I understand.
So we did come into agreement to try and incentivize all staff to test. And we've had greater numbers show up, so I'll just leave it at that for now.
Are you aware of any funding from the CARES Act that may assist with testing?
I'm sorry, say that again.
One of the questions that was raised was, are you aware of any funding from the CARES Act that may help in assisting with the testing?
We have been using CARES Act money.
Okay.
And we've been using CARES Act money to do a lot of things.
All right, anything else on the, from the board on pertaining to this particular agenda item? Thank you, Fred. I know that's it's a huge task that you're doing and very difficult. And thank you for reporting that out and giving us an update on what's going on. I want to bring up to some of the commissioners who asked me to put this on the next item on the agenda and are concerned about the Hawaii Community Correctional Center. Anybody want to ask Mr. Yoon why he's here, questions about that?
Well, the reason we wanted HCCC on it is that HCCC has for decades been our most crowded facility. And one example, Fred, of where we raised concern about this is the department did forward to us all of the pandemic plans for each of the facilities. And this was early on, so I would say this was maybe May or June that they forwarded us the first batch. They did forward us updated ones later. in the ACCC pandemic plan, they identified holding cells, cell 23, 24, and 25, for the people who had to be isolated and or quarantined. Soon after we got that, I requested information on where all the women in the CCC were housed, and I was told they were housed in cells 23, 24, 25, and the Punahele visiting room. So this plan to use these cells for isolation and quarantine were in direct conflict with how they were being used on a daily basis as the housing for the women. And that's one of our concerns. Again, Fred, I want to stress, members of this commission have worked for corrections for very long times. We know how difficult it is to manage the population and how overcrowding has been a chronic problem. So we are not just pointing at public safety saying you're not doing a good job, but we want to respond to what we see as some conflicts and things we have to think through better.
So is there something specific that you want me to answer or respond
to?
No,
I just wanted to bring to your attention that is an example of conflict we have at ACCC, that the facility in their pandemic plan identified holding cells for quarantine and isolation, while at the same time those holding cells hold women for regular housing. So there was nothing in the plan about where you're going to relocate the women.
Okay. Well, I do believe that each of the facilities' pandemic plans are in the process of being updated as conditions change. Now, ACCC, since that time, as you know, did have that barricade and fire. Yeah. So that, of course, took out Dorm A, which is not going to be habitable until the middle of next month. So, of course, everything has to change, and the plans have to change, and people have to adjust. But in order to accomplish the testing, as I said earlier, we really had to shift and move bodies, you know, just lack of a better word, bodies, so that we could provide decent space and quarantine space. So I do hear you. And, you know, as conditions change, we have to change as well.
Thank you, Fred, for listening to our concern on that agenda item. Appreciate your time. We'll move on. Martha?
You know, of course, we are concerned about the fire or the disturbance that took place in the Waianui-Nui dormitory and in the newspaper. Again, we're just getting this from the paper about the inmates trying to move close together. And again, ACCC ended up with a very small disturbance where two inmates were arrested as a result of that. And I don't have an answer for you, Fred, but it's just, it's a continued concern about how bad ACCC is. And also from previous reports we received, Halinani was greatly underpopulated as the Punahele campus was extremely crowded. And so I would like you to really consider how better you can use the space between Halinani and the Punahele complex.
Okay, let me respond to that. First, with that inmate assault on the ACO, the ACO was doing their job. Mm-hmm. The motive behind that, I really don't want to go into that in open forum because it is a security matter. However, the table should have been separated and the inmate or two inmates were trying to force the issue with the ACO. Mm-hmm. And Mark, you know that kind of action that goes down over there. And Ted, I think you're familiar too. But, you know, we're not going to allow that. And I, even as acting director, would have to support the ACOs on that. Unfortunately, the ACO, I think he had to get immediate medical attention. But the ACO did not instigate it because the other two inmates did. And I'm very familiar with that. And this was not just a one-time thing. This was just something that was building up as well. But the other thing is Halinani is a community furlough center. So we cannot take close medium type custodies out of Wainuinui and Pomohana side and move them down to Halinani, which is really unsecured.
So that I understand that. I understand that. And first of all, I was not implying at all that it was the ACO's fault for the encounter that took place. So please be, okay, you know, be cleared of that. I was not implying that at all. It's just, we can consider reclassification of some people. We have built into our classification system certain givens, such as a pretrial will be medium. But when during a time such as this, you can review your pretrial population and see whether you can do exception cases and bring any of them down to a custody that will allow them to move to Halinani. So that is what I'm suggesting. You know, we need to rethink things.
Well, let me tell you that there are the exceptions, and Kulani and Halinani do have the minimum exception, like what you're talking about.
Well, Kulani is a minimum security facility.
Well, they have taken what they call mediums and put them as an exception minimum.
Good. And I presume that was after the fire?
No, this was from before.
Okay.
Mark, I had a text from Steve Costa and Dan Mystic. They want to be let in if they aren't already.
So we have heard those type of cases at parole hearings for the last several months. So this was well in place beforehand.
Nothing else, Mark.
Okay. Sorry, I was trying to address Mike's concern. Okay, thank you. Any other things from the commissioners on this agenda item? If not, I'll move forward to the status of the Hawaii Supreme Court action related to COVID-19 cases in correctional facilities. Mr. Tabe, can you share with us what's going on?
Yeah, for everyone, my name is James Tabe. I'm with the Office of the Public Defender. Also present at the meeting is Ms. Jacqueline Esser with the Public Defender's Office as well. Basically, we filed a second petition back in August 12th. And since August 12th, there was I just put some matters in perspective here. The population on August 12th was approximately 973 inmates at OCCC. As of the most recent count that I received, we're down to 846. Obviously, it's an improvement, but nothing close to where we would like it to be. The actual releases pursuant to Supreme Court order are very few now. We usually get only one or two every few days. It's not even every day. But just a few days ago, there were about five or six people released. The only good news out of this is that they are releasing people without addresses. So they are not focusing on that. So it's a variety. Most of the releases, though, are probation violation type cases. So at this point, our circuit court attorneys, I believe, are just filing motions in general, regular motions, and for release, bail reduction, supervised release, etc. And I don't think those are being counted in the Supreme Court releases. I'm going to give most of the credit for keeping the numbers down as they are, you know, to the district court section. I don't have hard numbers, but anecdotally, at district court arraignment in courtroom 7C, when they first make their first, the custodies make their first appearances, they're getting released. the vast majority, you know, it's definitely the rule and not the exception, as opposed to pre-pandemic. They were holding many more people in for these minor petty misdemeanor and misdemeanor things. Progress is being made, at least at the district court level, without even any order. They are, or whether they're using the order, I don't know what the judges are basing it on, but they've been very cooperative at the district court level there. There is a, so MOOC, the petition basically is, the current petition, I guess, is just languishing, maybe. I don't know what the right word is in Supreme Court. The ACLU recently, and I won't say recently, it's actually almost 2 weeks, filed an amicus brief seeking certain remedies, and they haven't even, Supreme Court hasn't even ruled on whether the brief can be filed, even though they did technically file a brief because it was a exhibit to their motion. But they are seeking, as for relief is, I'm just going to go over it real quickly for the, put it in the record. It can be filed on Hoiki if the actual motion and the exhibit. They're seeking, number one, to prioritize the release of incarcerated persons who are medically vulnerable and those with disabilities. Number two, they want to have the Supreme Court set initial capacity targets. Number three, they want have appointed an independent public health expert with medical expertise to go into all facilities, including Saguaro, to review the capacities and the implementation of the pandemic response plan and testing. Four, they would like to require public safety to comply with their statutory mandates, provide reentry planning and services for people returning to the community. Five, they want to increase and regularize testing at all facilities. And six, they want to make sure the Supreme Court retains jurisdiction until the pandemic has entirely passed, and unlike the first petition where they closed out the case. So, like I said, they haven't even ruled on whether this brief can be filed, or they're, you know, so we're there at that point. If Ms. Esser has anything, that's all basically I have to state here. Unless Ms. Esser has any comments, she could probably enlighten us on what the actual, what's going on at circuit court, since I'm now confined to my office for the most part here.
Sure. As far as circuit court, and aloha everyone, I'm sorry, I don't have video this morning, but as far as circuit court, what has been helping keeping the front door open or closed a little bit is that recently the judges have, when someone is on pretrial supervision, so like supervised release being monitored by OISC, and they file an affidavit to revoke if they have violated a term of their supervision. The normal procedure is that the intake worker through the prosecutor files a revocation of their supervision, a bench warrant is issued. I have noticed probably within the last 3 weeks that judges have not been issuing bench warrants immediately, and they're setting it for hearing, allowing counsel to attempt to get a hold of the person and have them come to court. I have not seen yet what happens when the person doesn't come to court for those hearings. I'll find out next week. I have a few to see if the court will continue it still with the attempt trying to get a hold of the person and by other means than issuing an arrest. But that has helped. And also at arraignments at circuit court, so we're talking about felony arraignments, pre-COVID, the numbers are generally around 20, I would say 20 on average, sometimes up to 30 new arraignments, and that happens twice a week. the numbers when we during the first release efforts went down drastically, and then when the Supreme Court let go of jurisdiction, it went right back up to pre-COVID arraignments. So the prosecutors were charging as they normally do. However, when the second wave of COVID happened, we noticed that the prosecutors went back to using discretion and not charging cases right away that didn't have to be. So the numbers are down again. The last time I did arraignments, 2 weeks ago, I think the calendar was at three to five people. So that also helps keep the numbers as far as people coming into the jail on the front door down. However, the numbers are going to start creeping up because there's no back door. You know, jury trials aren't happening, so people are just sitting. We're seeing, you know, so that's a problem. So we have to keep that front entry door down. And that's all I have to add. Thank you.
Any of the commissioners have any questions right now for James or Ms. Esther?
I have a question for either Jackie or James. One of the findings after the first wave of releases was that a large majority of those who returned to jail returned because of issues related to their homelessness. Do you see an improvement in services available to the people being released now and more recently?
Jack, you want to take this?
So the only actually, it's really challenging right now if someone doesn't have shelter or if they're trying to get into a program. Many of the programs just aren't, there's a moratorium on accepting people from OCCC. So I think that it's in a way more difficult to find someone a place to go. There is luckily a lot of community support with a lot of the people here at this meeting. I'm trying to find
I'm good. I'm real
find
good.
Bed I'm... spaces, and we're trying to link their efforts with our office so our attorneys can help coordinate that. But what's difficult is that when people are being released and they're, you know, let's just say that they have no shelter and they have no phone, they have no computer, maintaining contact right now is extremely difficult, if not impossible. And so we're seeing many of these affidavits to revoke based on solely that they haven't been in contact, not that there's been another crime committed or something like that. So which is why it is nice to see, and I don't know who's putting pressure on the judiciary, but I think someone has said something that they're not automatically issuing a bench warrant if it's not a threat, if it's just a technical violation like that. And hopefully we can find other ways and support to get the person to court and help. But so unfortunately, that's still a problem that we would love to see more like collaboration and triage to help these people just be able to follow through with the terms of their supervision.
Just a follow-up question then. For those who are not being charged, or for those who are being released to the system now, what kind of crimes are they being charged with? If you know.
Sure. So through the Supreme Court releases, it was mostly people charged with, UCPV, a drug possession, theft, things like that, of that nature. Like Mr. Tabe said, most of those releases have trickled down to essentially nothing at this point. So now individual attorneys are just filing motion for supervised release, just, you know, how we always do and argue for releases. And you can do that on any, you're not precluded by the nature of the offense. And so it just depends on the individual case and facts and circumstances and the person's history. You know, the judge would make the decision if the person could be safely released into the community.
Thank you for that, Jackie. But I was I should have been more focused in my phrasing. I was interested in those who you have trouble getting a hold of for these technical violations. What kinds of charges are they up for?
Their criminal charge. Is that what you're asking? Yeah, so mostly possession cases or property offenses. So,
okay.
But with the exception of burglary. So thefts, UCPV, things like, I would say things like that. And the judge will review when in deciding whether or not to issue a bench warrant right away. The judge reviews their history. And if they, based on their review, decide it's not necessary right now to issue the bench warrant. We've seen that they're allowing us more time to try and get the person in without the issuance of a warrant.
Thank you. I think Jackie, now's the time to go ahead, Ron.
Okay, Jackie, this is Ron Ibarra. Regarding the district courts that you mentioned were issuing, I guess, summons instead of or letting the attorneys bring in the clients on a revocation motion. Is this across the board and statewide, or is this a bullet for certain circuits?
So I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Mr. Tabe does. This is just what I have seen happening at the First Circuit. It appears because all of the judges have started doing that. It's not just one individual judge. It appears that they have been instructed to do this. So I would assume that probably instruction came from the chief and that would apply statewide. But again, that's just speculation. I don't know where that's coming from.
Thank you.
Mark? Chair?
Yes.
Just to touch on what Tommy said, that because OCCC cannot control all the intakes once the court has ruled, you know, I did have a conversation with Intake Service Center, Frank Young, the new administrator, and they are going to look at relaxing the criteria on the petty misdemeanors and misdemeanors. And he should have a conversation with Judge May. So hopefully we can effect more releases from district court and minimize the number of pretrial petty misdemeanors and misdemeanors coming into OCCC. On what Jackie said, she's very much correct on the community resources. You know, on the parole side, we will only revoke if it's absolutely necessary, and not necessarily on technical violations. But, for example, say John Duda was cleaning sober houses. When parole board grants parole, they're backed up 150 on the waiting list. To go to Poilani, it's 60 to 80 on a waiting list and 6 months before they may consider acceptance into the program. Most of the programs now are wanting to have negative test results before they'll accept the individual into their program. So it's very, very difficult to grant release to the community resources. Medical release, of course, we're going to be calling on Robert and Fran Dudowa. But even I know they're having struggle with finding appropriate placements there too. So I think, Tommy, how much did we have backed up on charity sets?
Do they have release dates or not release dates?
not release dates?
We had 168.
So we had granted parole on a chair to set, and we didn't have dates yet because we couldn't get confirmation for residents on 160 plus orders. So, you know, again, system, we're kind of in a bind because we have lack of placements. But on the front end, if we can get the courts to relax the criteria, hopefully we can affect at least First Circuit or Triple C.
That's a lot of good information to hear that you guys are working in trying to reduce those populations. And Fred, we're talking about all the facilities at this time, yes?
Yes.
Not just OCCC? Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. OCCC for the pretrial population, which Judge May oversees, but the CCCs on the neighbor islands have less intakes coming in, and we've coordinated with Judge Kim and HCCC to do more video type arraignments. They got that hooked up about 3 weeks ago. They're having a lot of problems at one point, but it seems to be working out well now.
And hopefully those video or Zoom sessions that they can have with the judicial courts there will help expedite the releases or at least bail.
Well, it all depends on the type of case, yeah, and type of hearing. Maybe we can pull back Ronnie Barr into a service again.
I do speak to the judges, you know, I'll tell you that informally. And
so I'm running into you.
So, but you're right, you know, it comes down, no matter what you can do, it was said by Jackie or whatever, somebody has to talk to the judges and the judges, because it's a sort of a judicial independence issue. The judges have to buy in. That's basically it.
Any more questions for Mr. Tame or Ms. Esser at this time? Thank you, guys. It's a lot of information you put forth. I appreciate the Director of Public Safety giving us, added on some more information. We just got to process that and see where we go from this point, but we appreciate the update at this time. Commissioners, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next item, which is our report on the emergency capacity at correctional facilities. I'm going to just say a little bit, and then Ted's going to take over at this time. It's about 10:03, and then I'll be back in a little bit. But it's really, we've been asked since March to create a capacity for our correctional facilities should COVID-19 really get out of hand. And it took us some time to put it together. All the thanks to Martha, who brainstormed this entire report. I believe, Lisa, is it still posted on the website?
Yes, it is.
Yes, okay. It is.
So if you haven't seen it, that's where you can find it. So the discussion is going to be, I talked about it. What does the document mean? Where do we go from here? And Martha and Ted's going to lead on the discussion at this time. So, Martha?
Well, Ted, did you want to say anything first?
No, actually... I should have reviewed the agenda more carefully before it went out, but I thought we were going to receive public testimony today, because I think we have to go through that step for several reasons before we can really finalize it. Yeah. So anyway, no, I didn't have anything to say right now.
Okay, for the last meeting, I did do a very quick overview of this report, but I'm gonna go more in depth now. And I apologize for last week. I was ill at that time, and I went to the doctor soon after, and I'm feeling a lot better now. Anyway, the Correctional Population Management Commission was created in part to establish operating capacities for each of our correctional facilities. By statute, only the CPMC could create those capacities, not the Department of Public Safety. And we have abided by them, including them. I shouldn't say, no, we have not abided by them. We've exceeded them consistently. But in the department's population report, the spreadsheet put out each month. It has always included the design capacity of each facility, the CPMC capacity of each facility, and then what is the actual population. So what we did in this report was take the CPMC report as a baseline and then incorporate into a CDC recommendations. We did not come up with total new capacities for the facilities, but rather living unit by living unit. And so an example would be at one point, the department provided to us that module 17 was being used for males in quarantine. So we said, if you're using module 17 for that purpose, this is the capacity during that period of time. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you're changing the capacity for module 7. It's only the one that's being used for that. So that's why we didn't come up with totals. The CPMC report is very clearly a space analysis. Mm-hmm. And it's based on how many people the actual physical facility and the infrastructure could hold at any one time. So in doing that, of course, we did a lot of infrastructure analysis, which included the sewers, the water, the signaling, you know, lighting, everything like that. ACA guidelines, American Correctional Association guidelines, and the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare guidelines. Once you come up with those capacities, and that's in our 2001 report, other factors impact capacity. They will not make it greater than what the CPMC states, but it may bring that capacity down. So example would be, what type of staff or how many staff do you have available? What are the program offerings at that facility? What is the medical capacity to respond to medical needs? What is the inmate classification? That is not included in the 2001 report, but rather was deferred to public safety for them to manage that way. I want to make it perfectly clear. Rarely in the last 30 years has the department been able to achieve the operating capacity. It does not have the ability to do this on its own. It can be, my personal opinion is I put a lot of the responsibility to the legislature for not enacting laws to increase the population without any concern of the impact on corrections, but also not funding the department so it could adequately handle the number of people assigned to it. Anyway, in applying the CDC recommendations, we considered the March 23rd report from CDC on corrections, which was updated July 22nd. In their reports, they broke it down into three sections: operational preparedness, prevention, and management. It is under the management section that they talk about how people should be medically isolated and or quarantined. One of the things that they stress in that report near the beginning, which we all are very clear on here, you need to reduce admissions as they come in from the police and the courts, and also greatly limit any transfers. But that's really a given. And I know public safety and the public defender in their court filings are trying to address that. In the CDC recommendation for medical isolation, and they never back away from this, they say that an inmate who is infected must be placed in a separate environment from other individuals, more or less meaning in a separate cell. They should not be mingling with other individuals as long as they are need to be in medical isolation. In quarantine, they do divide it between close contact, where you know that the person has had contact with someone with COVID, versus new admissions, where it's really an unknown. But basically what they're saying is cohorting, which means more than one person in a cell or in a living unit, can be accomplished, but should only be practiced if there is not any other available option. Now, when we look at our facilities like Rayava and Kulani, they are all dormitories, so of course there would be cohorting then. In a cohort, though, the CDC does not back away from saying at each different level, depending upon how crowded you are, there should be, quote, at least 6 feet of personal space assigned to each individual in all directions. So that's what was taken into consideration in coming up with these unit capacities. The Department of Public Safety has told us that they will get a response to us at the end of October, and so that's nearing. I'm afraid, though, they're really going to be concentrating on how they can achieve these capacities, and we recognize that. But also I was concerned with one response we got from public safety that they really didn't understand what capacities was all about. They responded on May 20th to a letter they wrote for three facilities, Kulani, Women's, OCCC, that they use the same quote. We asked them, because we received at that time the capacity for each living unit, not just for the facility as a whole. And the capacities for each living unit exceeded the CPM capacities for the whole. And the response for each of these was, the CPMC capacity is from 2001. Capacities and physical layouts have significantly changed 19 years later. The CPM capacities do not meet current population increases. They were never designed to meet population increases. They were designed to give public safety the tools it needed to go to the legislature and other decision-making bodies to say, we should not be exceeding this many people on this site. So I really hope the corrections begins to understand the purpose of doing capacity analysis. It is for, it's a tool for you to use to argue your position and why you need to reduce the population. Things that we have been concerned about is when it was announced that an inmate was killed at OCCC, he was housed with two other inmates in a cell, and in the reports to the media, we did not follow this up with public safety, but in the reports to the media, both Civil Beat and the Honolulu Star Bulletin, it said that all three were infected with COVID-19. Three people in an 80 square foot cell. So that is greatly exceeding what CDC is recommending. And then I've already talked about, another example they gave us, they told us the last meeting they were using module 17 to quarantine males that were in the intake process. And if we estimated that a very low number of males were coming in during the weekdays, only 10, they are supposed to be quarantined for 14 days in a 14-day period with 10 days of admission. That would be 100 inmates. Yet module 17 has only 24 cells. So that means at the end of the 14 days, you would have quadruple celling and then four extra inmates on top of that. So, we are concerned that the plans are not realistic in what they can address. And again, Fred, I want to stress to you, we understand that meeting these capacities is almost an impossibility, but we're hoping the state, in court cases especially, uses this report as part of its defense as to what should be housed based on the needs of the inmate at any particular time.
Good, thank you.
Just a couple of comments I'd like to make. First of all, Martha referred to ACA guidelines. They're actually pretty well-established standards that are accepted by most correctional jurisdictions across the country. And there's a very rigorous process which were established and are continually updated. When we did the capacities back in 2001, we used the standards that were in place back then. And I'm pretty sure the standards have advanced since then, but I have no reason to believe that the space standards would have changed significantly at this point. So, the standards are used to get facilities accredited, and Saguaro is accredited, and Saguaro has a team that's simply devoted to make sure they can stay accredited. So they pay very careful attention to the uses of their spaces. The second thing I'd like to say is that when you review the proposed emergency capacities, there's a section on conditions, and these conditions are designed to ensure that during quarantine, nobody is unnecessarily put in a lockdown situation. In fact, in the existing capacities from 2001, a lot of the double celling, for example, is conditioned on out of cell time. because the standards across the country are very clear that inmates should not be locked in their cell unless there's good reason through a established process. Otherwise, inmates should not be kept locked in their cells more than, I believe the national standard is more than 10 hours a day. And we made some flexibility in 2001 based on facility operations. But for example, at Halava, the then commission allowed for double celling of the cells on the condition that the inmates be allowed out of cell for, I believe it was 12 hours a day, something to that effect. So these conditions that we have on the emergency capacities are very important too, because we don't wanna see inmates locked up throughout the day in the cell, because these cells are pretty small, they're pretty dark. And so anyway, when you read that, please pay attention to the conditions.
Ted, I also wanna add to that, the CDC report also goes out of its way to say that medical isolation must be greatly different from other type of isolation that's done for punitive reasons or done because the inmate is dangerous to others in the facility, mm-hmm. that you need to provide services, reading materials, other things that can keep them occupied while they are locked in the cell all day.
Thank you. You know, at this point, Rather than moving to the next item, I'd just like to ask if anybody out there has any questions about what the document is. I believe it's posted on the Attorney General's website. Mm-hmm. And Martha, the rest of the commission can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe our intent is to get input from the public at some future date, hopefully yes. soon. And we did share this earlier on with the Department of Public Safety at least a month ago. And as Martha indicated, we expect their response to our draft by the end of October. So if anybody has any questions about this document and how to read it, this is a good time. And I'm looking at the screen for any hands that might be raised.
I have a question.
Okay, and who is this?
This is Carrie-Anne Chiroltis.
Okay.
Thank you. I haven't had a chance to carefully review it, so I'll reserve time to do that later on. But this is just more of a question of looking ahead. You know, even when you have plans that have been approved, even the best of plans is just a paper. What can be done to implement those plans, and particularly in regard to the Supreme Court? Will there be an effort from the Oversight Commission to maybe provide this to the court through an amicus brief? Because it seems like in the past Supreme Court orders, in several orders, they reference the Oversight Commission and making deference to the commission to really have oversight over these issues. And I think that the court is looking to you for guidance in setting that capacity, and if that capacity is set and the court incorporates that as part of their order, there is this order to guide the judiciary, PSD, you know, probation, parole, all of the criminal justice / you know, different agencies that are involved in this. So I'm looking ahead, is there a plan or strategy to ensure that to implement it and utilizing the Supreme Court, their ability and authority to pass an order that incorporates and sets these limits?
Any of the commission members want to tackle that? It's a good question. What I can say is that it will be a public document, first of all. Secondly, the charge to this commission is not only to set the commission, but also set policies to make sure that does not exceed these capacities that are set. And we had tackled, we had discussed how we're gonna approach the second part, but it's a huge thing. And so we thought it was more important to get the numbers down first, at least before we move on to the next stage. So Carrie-Anne, it's an excellent question, but we're only in the beginning stages, and as you know, we're still struggling along without any staff and any budget. But excellent question. I think the commission can decide that we would forward this to all parties in the legal action, the Supreme Court, public defender, et cetera, once we have the capacity set. I think that might be a way to get some attention to this.
Thank you.
There is a mechanism as far as this commission's jurisdiction is oversight. And as far as like we've been doing, we can ask public safety about first having established the capacity in an authorized manner. And we can ask public safety if they are in compliance. And certainly the last resorts, which we hope we don't have to do, is go to the Supreme Court and ask for enforcement.
But Judge Ibarra, this is Carrie Ann again. I just want to comment upon that. And this is based in part upon discussions. There is a Maui reentry hui that involves different MCCC staff, probation, parole, a lot of nonprofits, MEO. And even the prosecutor's office has been invited and they're planning to participate. And part of the consensus is that they have all said that if the court issues an order, then there is more likely for any type of order to be implemented and swiftly in a time frame because everyone wants to be in compliance. And I think history has shown us that when we just rely upon goodwill, it doesn't happen. If you look at the trajectory of the population increase, and this is not again just to say any particular agency, it's to show that currently with the Supreme Court order and all of these different agencies working together more collaboratively, there could still be room for improvement, but there's definitely progress. That when there's in court order and there's oversight from the court, things are more likely to be done. That is also true when there's been a consent decree with the federal government for PSD. And so I think the lesson for us is that since this court case is open and the court has specifically more than once referred to the Oversight Commission as waiting for guidance from you, I think that providing that to them and maybe an amicus brief, there may be other mechanisms that they could maybe keep this case open. Because I'd hate for them, as in the first order where they essentially said, okay, we've done all we can and we're going to close the case. We know that the pandemic is not going away at any time soon. So having it open and having guidance from the commission with these capacity limits, I think will be instructive for them to issue an order. And then there will be more collaboration between intake, you know, probation, parole, judiciary, public safety, and even for the community to partner to ensure that people can get out and have places to live and stay in the community. Thank you.
I agree. Certainly, if it came down from the Supreme Court initially, that would be the word, the final word. Having said that, having looked at the Supreme Court orders, basically, there's some reference in working with our commission, right? Having public safety work with our commission. And if the public safety say, yeah, we agree. And so there's no case of controversy. Because we agreed what the commission, hopefully they'll agree with us. But nevertheless, that's one option. In the end, the final word will hopefully come from the Supreme Court.
To be real honest with you, my feeling is that like Martha alluded to, the real game is going to be at the legislature, because we had discussed earlier about lack of services in a community for those who are released. We really need some major investments to rebuild the social safety network, I believe. I think I agree with the need to rebuild some of our facilities. They are in bad, bad shape, but we have to do it in a very thoughtful manner. But I think the legislature will have to be a player, and sometimes when you have the hard numbers, you have a better chance of getting their attention. The Act 65 report, I think, contains some really profound direction for the state. But you know, until the legislature acts, it's just a report. And so I think together we have to leverage whatever constituencies we have to move the legislature also, as well as the other players. My comment. Any other comments? Okay, so.
Martha, Fred. Yeah. You know, I wholeheartedly agree with what you guys are saying, and you know, we've been through these rounds together, especially at LEDGE. And you know, I would welcome the both of you that the upcoming LEDGE session, if we have anything there, if you come in and support our efforts as well. Because you know, there's power in numbers, yeah. And sometimes public safety speaking by themselves gets nowhere fast. That's what I want to tell you.
I hear you, Fred. Been there, done that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I would ask everybody out there who's interested in the capacities, take a look at the report. If you have any questions, I think between now and the time we schedule a forum for you to provide your input, please feel free to contact Mark Patterson, since he's not here. That's what he gets for leaving us. And one of us will get back to you. Okay, with that, the next item on the agenda is updates on the oversight coordinator position. Lisa, do you have any updates for us?
Unfortunately, no. There's no news since the last update last month. So, I mean, the AG's office resubmitted a request to BNF for the funds. No response.
Okay, we'll have Mark follow up with the Attorney General's office on this.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to open for more public comments. I noticed Lillian has a comment on testing at Saguaro. Lillian?
Maybe she's gone lost.
Lillian, you're on mute. If you're there, you're on mute.
Ted, can I say something?
This Go is ahead, Kat.
Aloha, everybody, and thank you so much to the commission for the work that you're doing under the most extreme circumstances. No staff, no money, no nothing. So you're kind of living the community life now. This is how we operate. I am really concerned because the reports that I'm getting from the facilities are not what I'm hearing from the department, and that has been a real problem. One of the problems at Halava is that the guards, the ACOs, go to the quarantine section, they provide lunch to those people or meals for those people, and then they go right to the healthy section with the same PPEs. So that's a problem. The second problem is that a lot of the men are saying they don't want to go to an overcrowded and unventilated chow hall. So because they don't do that, they don't eat. And some of the men have not eaten in the chow hall for 80 days, and they're living on the stuff from the commissary, mostly ramen. That is not healthy, and especially during a pandemic, I am really, really concerned about the health of people who are immunocompromised. And the third thing—
Excuse me, Kat. This second problem, which facility are you referring
to? Halava.
Okay.
Yeah, these are all Halava, three things from Halava. And the last thing is that the department said everybody is tested, but that is not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that some of the men in Halava refuse to be tested because they don't want to be locked down. And I know a man who was tested, who's in a facility, in a pod with people who refuse to be tested. So I'm really concerned for his health because he's an older guy. So these are the things that I'm hearing that are not what I'm hearing from the department. And that is concerning to me. And about Saguaro, there are some very, very big problems there. And I sent the commission a letter that I've gotten from family who are attorneys. And they see what's going on there. And it's very frightening because the department is not really doing what it can to protect the health and safety of our people. Thank you.
Okay. Fred, can we count on you to look into these issues?
Kat, as normal, like you usually do, email it to me and we'll look specifically into your observations or reports.
Thank you, Fred.
Okay. Lillian, are you still with us?
I'm trying to, please excuse me for my technical difficulties. Yes, okay. I am. Thank you.
Okay.
My concern is also what I am receiving as information through the news media that Saguaro is temperature checking individuals. Is the temperature checking for those who are at risk, those who are in the infirmary, those who are staff? Is it all of the above? Because I know you're limited in being able to test everyone, but my concern again is just who and exactly how are these temperature testings done?
Lillian, as far as you know at this time, anybody who comes into the facility is temperature checked, and anyone who's out in the isolation and confinement areas are checked, and medical.
Lillian, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay. Any other questions or comments or testimonies anybody wants to provide at this time?
Yes, this is Carrie Ann again, Chirota.
Go ahead, Carrie Ann.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm hearing some background. But I wanted to ask some follow-up questions to director and to all of you relating to COVID testing at Saguaro. So I have received information and I did send this letter to the director and he did respond to me initially. But I have some concerns. So I have a client, but I know of at least two people of Saguaro. One client who had symptoms, which could be indicative of the flu or COVID. Body heat, sweats, chills, body aches, coughing. And despite all of those symptoms, and they were in the pod where there was the shutdown, this individual and the other individual, two of them, I know at least two, maybe others, were not tested for COVID. And so I'm concerned that despite assurances from CCA/CoreCivic that they may be providing information to the state, that's not entirely accurate. So the concern for me is that CDC has very clear guidelines. Since we are moving and we're implementing universal testing in the different facilities, is there any mandate coming from PSD, since PSD has contracted for services with CoreCivic to start and implement universal testing intermittently, but even more immediately for those who are exhibiting symptoms to test for COVID currently? And when I say test, not to necessarily test. In this case, these individuals were been given, I'm not sure if it was ibuprofen or Tylenol, but some fever reducing medicine. If you give people the fever reducing medicine and then you're testing temperature, you're not necessarily going to get an accurate reading whether they have a high fever if you're giving the fever inducing medicine, which I can understand that may be a treatment, But again, it behooves to do the testing currently. So on a larger scale, when Nevada, when some of Nevada's incarcerated population at Saguaro were tested positive, my understanding is that Nevada's Department of Corrections required courses as part of their contractual duties to test all of the population. So my question is our department requesting, or not requesting, demanding as part of the contract that the world tests, do universal testing, and more immediately for those exhibiting symptoms of COVID?
Fred, you don't have to answer that. I mean, I think we've gone through this before where members of the public should not be questioning other participants in the meeting. Commissioners can question all they want, but in order to keep the meeting going, we should not have members of the public questioning other participants.
Okay, so I understand. So I'll just turn it into a comment. I would respectfully request that the Department of Public Safety and the Oversight Commission require universal testing for all of our incarcerated population at Saguaro, regardless of whether it's a private prison. We still have custody, we still have responsibility for the care, health, and well-being of our incarcerated, despite being thousands of miles away. And if we're just gonna leave it to CCA, whether they feel like testing or not, it's not gonna happen. History has shown, and more currently, that Nevada required it, and so I'm hoping that our department will do the same. Thank you.
Okay, Carrie Ann, let me see if I understood your comments. You started with perhaps two inmates, perhaps more, in a housing unit where others were being isolated, had COVID-like symptoms, but did not receive testing. That was one concern. And the second I heard, the second request was whether the state of Hawaii will invoke its contract, and if so allowed, require that Saguaro test, implement universal testing for Hawaii inmates at Saguaro.
Yes, so universal testing, but also the third, well, that could be kind of together, but universal, but also for those exhibiting symptoms to do the tests, because... COVID.
I'm sorry, Carrie Ann, this...
It sounds like there's a lot more.
I couldn't make out what you're saying.
It just, for me, and the other part of that is whether... not whether, since I'm not asking a question, but PSD requiring them to conduct testing for those exhibiting COVID, because medical providers, to my knowledge, cannot determine whether someone has COVID or the flu by their symptoms. The only way that you can determine conclusively if someone has COVID is through a test.
Okay, we'll pass the comments on.
Thank you. And then I did have a few other comments relating to other matters that you discussed.
What is that sound anyway? Does anybody else hear that?
Yeah.
I'm muting it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Sounded like a lawnmower or something, a leaf blower. Thank you. I know that this will be for future agendas discussing the possible building of OCCC. Given the numbers that the director has shared about the wait list at Poilani, other treatment programs, even other clean and sober homes that may be slowing admissions or not accepting more persons from either MCCC or elsewhere, that just shows that there is the need, right, for community-based alternatives. And so we need to go back to the larger question is, do we want to spend 500 plus million into building a jail versus investing into community-based solutions? There could be so many community-based treatment programs, from substance abuse, vocational training, education, behavioral health, family strengthening, cultural programs in the community with that 500 plus million. So for us to really think about alternatives to incarceration, and then is there the justification for the proposed 1,000 plus beds for OCCC as we've seen recently with the COVID numbers and cross collaboration between multi-agencies, that the numbers can come down, the population can be reduced through intentional strategic policies. And then if the numbers continue to come down, which it can, I believe it will, is there again, how do you justify the 1,000 plus beds for this proposed project?
Thank you. It will be the subject of at least one more future meeting, if not more. Anybody else have any comments they want to offer at this time?
I do, Dan.
Go ahead, Dan.
All right, thank you. And I just want to follow up on Carrie Ann's comments. I really appreciate them, and just want to reaffirm that unfortunately, we've seen other jurisdictions across the country who have tried to expand their jails, but once they start looking at the ways in which diversion can be deployed and the ways in which the health system can be relied on, they really quickly began to realize that they don't have to expand the jail in that way. And by looking at input from community members and users of these facilities and also correctional staff, there have been concerted efforts to try and move in the direction of creating a much more therapeutic environment, not just for the people who are detained, but also for the people who are working there. And I think that we can't forget about them in all of this process too, because this is such a taxing job to work at, and I don't envy any of them. So I just want to encourage all of you to continue to keep your eye on that ball of diversion opportunities. And again, I know this is the mantra that I repeat often, or the dead horse that I continue to beat in front of all of you. But Medicaid and MedQuest really can carry a lot of the burden when it comes to treatment options and alternatives to incarceration and deflection opportunities. But that requires concerted effort and communication between DSH or DHS, DOH, and also DPS. And I would just encourage you to keep eyes open for opportunities for that. And I'm always here to help, and I'm looking for ways in which I can try and help those conversations along. So thank you all for what you're doing, and just keep up the good work, everyone, under very stressful conditions.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. Anybody else? If not, we'll close the meeting. Thank you all very much for your interest and for your participation. And please submit your comments on the capacities report, and we will be scheduling something to receive your comments. Martha.
Our next meeting, setting the date for the next meeting.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
November 19th is the third Thursday in November.
Okay. For Ron and Mike, does it work for you?
That's fine with me.
Okay, November 19th, 9:00, and we'll let Mark do the honors of setting it up. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Mahalo.